Our next speaker, Tony Martin, has taught at Wellesley College, Massachusetts since 1973. He was tenured in 1975 and has been a full professor in Africana Studies since 1979. Prior to that, he taught at the University of Michigan Flint and the Cipriani Labor College in Trinidad and St. Mary's College in Trinidad. He has been a visiting professor at the University of Minnesota, Brandeis University, Brown University, and the Colorado College. He has also spent a year as an honorary research fellow at the University of the West Indies, Trinidad. Professor Martin has written or compiled and edited 11 books. In 1965, he qualified as a barrister at law at the Honorable Society of Gray's Inn, London. He also holds a Bachelor of Science Honors degree in economics at the University of Hull in England and a Master's and PhD degrees in history at the Michigan State University. His articles and reviews have appeared in the Journal of Negro History, American Historical Review, African Studies Review, Washington Post Book World, Journal of Caribbean History, Journal of American History, Black Books Bulletin, Science and Society, the Jamaica Journal, to name a few, and he has contributed to several anthologies and encyclopedia. Professor Martin is currently working on a study of European Jewish immigration into Trinidad in the 1930s. For some years now, the IHR has sold his book, The Jewish Onslaught, Dispatches from the Wellesley Battlefront, which we have on sale in the back, which deals with his experience that came about in part from his using the book, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, which we also have for sale there, as one of the sources for a course he was teaching. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Dr. Tony Martin.
First of all, thank you very much, Greg, for the introduction. I'd like to thank also the IHR and Mark Weber particularly for inviting me here. I'm very happy to be here to be part of this event. I like long-winded topics, at least topic titles, so I'll read the topic which I have selected for today. It's as follows: Jewish tactics as exemplified in the controversy over Jewish involvement in the transatlantic slave trade. That's Jewish tactics as exemplified in the controversy over Jewish involvement in the transatlantic slave trade. So I won't be speaking that much on this, on the controversy itself. What I'm trying to do is to use my subjective experience, that is the experience I've had for close to a decade now in dealing with this controversy. And what I'm going to try to do for the next half hour or hour or whatever is to use my concrete subjective experience on the firing line, so to speak, and I'm going to try to extract from my experience certain basic sort of tactics that I think that the Jewish lobby has used over the years pertaining to my particular situation. But in trying to extract these sort of principles or tactics from my subjective situation, I suspect that I may very well resonate with the experience of some other people here, because my suspicion is that there tends to be a generalized practice which transcends, you know, particular situations. So that even though in my case I was dealing with a specific situation, the transatlantic slave trade, my suspicion is that the kinds of tactics which were used against me may be not very dissimilar to many other folks who have been involved in other kinds of disputes with this particular lobby. The first thing I should do by way of introduction is just to basically summarize precisely what my controversy was. I know it's familiar to many people here, but I'm sure not to everybody in this audience. As was mentioned a minute ago in the introduction by Greg Raven, I teach at Wellesley College in Massachusetts. For many years, I've taught a survey course in African-American history. And in 1993, I introduced into my course, this is a one-semester course, it moves very rapidly over the whole gamut of African-American history, and I introduced in 1993 a book which is on sale at the back, a book which then was fairly new, a book which I myself had only just recently become introduced to. That is a book published by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam. The book is entitled The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews. And what that book did, relying primarily on the on sources written by Jews, Jewish sources of a variety of different types, that book tried to sort of synthesize the existing information on Jewish involvement in the slave trade, the bringing of Africans as slaves from Africa to the so-called New World. There wasn't that much in the book that was new in the sense that all the information practically was secondary information, which had been already published, although hidden away to a large extent in very esoteric Jewish journals, which the average Jew, I discovered later, had no idea about. Nevertheless, it wasn't new information. It was new to many people, including myself. And I found it very interesting that I had taught African-American history for many years, but had only been dimly aware of the role of Jews in that slave trade. What I discovered was that the Jewish role in that slave trade had been very cleverly camouflaged for many, many years. Where Jews were involved, usually they tended not to be identified as Jews, whereas, you know, where Christians were involved, where Muslims were involved, you know, there was ready identification, you know, of such persons by their ethnicity, by their religious affiliation, and so on. In the case of Jews, they would be called other things, Portuguese, Spanish, Brazilian, whatever. But, you know, that crucial identification tended to be obscured. So as a good professor, I think I'm a good professor, and, you know, I'm always on the lookout for new information to enrich my classes. So I was very fascinated by this new information and decided to add a few readings from this book in my class. And that's when, as the saying goes, all hell broke loose. Apparently, I didn't realize it, but I actually stumbled into a controversy which was already, you know, brewing, because the book had apparently caused some consternation in Jewish circles. And it's only afterwards, when I went back and did my research, I discovered that one or two editorials had already appeared, you know, by way of the Jewish power structure, in a sense, warning people like myself to stay away from the book. There already apparently had been a full-page op-ed in the New York Times. I was told the longest op-ed that had ever been published in the New York Times. It was actually typeset in the form of a Star of David. It was written by someone called Henry Louis Gates, one of the black spokesmen for the Jewish lobby, somebody at Harvard University right now. Even the paper from my basic hometown, the Boston Globe, had carried an editorial, which I was unaware of at the time, but they had carried an editorial not long before I began to use the book. And in a sense, you know, the purpose of these editorials and op-eds was to warn folks to stay away from that book or else. But me, in my foolhardiness, ignored the warnings, being largely unaware of the warnings in the first place. And so I stumbled into this problem. Now, it so happens, again, I wasn't totally aware of all this, but by way of background, I know a little bit now more than I did then. But now I realize that Jews had, in fact, been involved not only in the African slave trade, but they had been involved in a variety of other slave trades, too, for a very long period of time. Apparently, they had actually dominated slavery and the slave trade in medieval times. On the plane on the way here, a couple of days ago, I was rereading a dissertation, a PhD dissertation from 1977 by a man called Harold D. Brackman, who is a functionary of the Simon Wiesenthal Center of all places. And he did a PhD dissertation detailing black-Jewish relations from ancient times up to 1900. And he actually mentions in his dissertation, he acknowledges the fact that Jews were the principal slave traders in the world for several hundred years, although in typical fashion, he puts a very interesting spin on it. He acknowledges, as I guess he has to, the Jews were the major slave traders in the world, trading slaves everywhere from Russia to Western Europe to India to China. But he says that they dominated the world trade only for a few hundred years, only. He says they were the main slave traders from the 8th century to the 12th century, but that was no big thing. It was only a few hundred years. I discovered also that the Jews were very instrumental in the ideological underpinning for the African slave trade, the notorious Hamitic myth, which more than any other single event provided the sort of ideological underpinning, the rationale for the slave trade. That this comes out of the Talmud, and this was, and in fact, Harold Brackman himself acknowledges that this was the first explication of the so-called story in Genesis about Ham, you know, being about Ham, the progenitor, so-called, of the African race, being cursed by Noah and so on. But apparently, according to Brackman, the Talmud was the first place that put a racist spin on this story. The biblical story was racially neutral, but the Talmud apparently put a very awful racist spin on this story, which later on became the basis, the ideological underpinning for the African slave trade. So all of this I was to discover as I became embroiled in this controversy. One of the things that interested me too was that the Jewish element was apparently also a major element in what came to be known in the 19th century as the white slave trade. The white slave trade apparently was a major multinational, you know, international trading in women and for sexual, you know, for immoral sexual purposes. The trafficking of women internationally as prostitutes and so on. And apparently the Jewish entrepreneurs in Europe apparently were also major figures in that so-called slave trade. And apparently many of the women they trafficked were some of their own women as well. So all of this, you know, I became aware of. As far as the African slave trade was concerned, just to summarize briefly what I discovered in the book, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, and in subsequent readings, I discovered that once the African slave trade got going in the 15th century, that again, Jews were a very important part of it. And again, the book was not suggesting, neither have I ever suggested, that the Jews were the only people involved, or even the major people involved. But you know, my basic, you know, point has always been that everybody else that I'm aware of who has been, you know, who was a part of the slave trade has acknowledged being part of the slave trade. Many of the people who were part of the genesis of the slave trade also became part of the abolitionist movement to end the slave trade. But as far as I know, the Jewish element is the only element that has, you know, resisted acknowledging the participation in this trade, and in fact have gone beyond merely resisting knowledge of this information coming out, but have become very upset when this information has come to the fore. And that has been my basic problem. You know, why? What's so special about this group that places them beyond the pale, so to speak, no pun intended, beyond the pale of criticism? You know, any other group can be criticized, but it seems to me that this group is beyond criticism. And especially for me as a black person, you know, I become very upset if someone tries to walk into my classroom to tell me that I, as a black person teaching black history, you know, I have to sort of regard their involvement in my history as somehow out of bounds. So they then were involved in the history via the Hamitic myth. They were some of the important financiers of this slave trade in the very early periods. One of the major multinational corporations that financed the Atlantic slave trade very early was the Dutch West India Company. And of course, as we know, the Jews had been chased out of Spain, chased out of Portugal, and the Netherlands was the one area, Holland, you know, which welcomed them to some degree. And this was right around the same time, the 15th century, that the slave trade was gearing up. So they were geographically positioned and positioned in other ways to become an important element in the financing of the Dutch West India Company, which was a major multinational corporation, you know, involved in the slave trade. In the early days, the 17th century, they were among, you know, in fact, they were a major element in the slave trade in places like Brazil, places like Suriname in South America, places like Curacao in the West Indies, places like Jamaica, Barbados, and other places as well. I discovered that they were also very well positioned in this country, that many of the slave traders, many of the people who brought slaves across the Atlantic from this country in colonial times were, in fact, Jewish ship owners and slave traders. Some of the best known names in that traffic coming out of colonial North America were people like Aaron Lopez, one of the best known names of all from Newport, Rhode Island, and others. I discovered the Jews owned many of the ancillary corporations that sort of fed into the slave trade. For example, rum distilling was one of the major areas that was ancillary to the slave trade, because rum was used as a trading, you know, an item of trade, you know, to exchange for slaves in West Africa. And I believe that most or all of the rum distilleries in places like Boston and elsewhere in New England were owned by Jews and so on. I discovered that according to the 1830 census, that even though Jews were a small proportion of the population in North America, nevertheless, they were inordinately represented among the slave owners. Yes, they were a small portion of the population overall, but on a percentage basis, apparently Jewish historians themselves have analyzed the 1830 census and have discovered that whereas for the white population as a whole, something like maybe 30-odd percent of the white population may have owned one or more slaves in the South, for Jewish households, it was over 70%. So on a percentage basis, Jews were more than twice as likely to own slaves, according to the 1830 census, according to an analysis of the 1830 census of the U.S. done by Jewish historians themselves. I also discovered that Jews, despite their involvement in the slave trade, were very few and far between in the abolitionist movement. They were less, much, much less likely than other groups to be involved in the abolitionist movement. So that, in a nutshell, then, is the, you know, the set of facts that caused me to become involved in this interesting controversy. And what I want to do, then, is to dwell not on the facts themselves, but on what I perceive to be the main tactics that were used, you know, because I found myself, like I said, on the front line of the situation, and I became very fascinated looking at the tactics. And the more I began to read around this question, the more I discovered that I saw parallels, you know, emerging in other kinds of situations as well. The first and major tactic that I discovered in their attack on me was the reliance on lies. That's straight up lies. There's no other way to describe it, just telling lies. Many of the categories that I will enumerate overlap, and many of them could also come under this general rubric of telling lies. But I think that if one had to isolate a single tactic, it was a tactic of telling lies. I think they have elevated telling lies to a very high artistic form. For example, very early in my controversy, the major Jewish organizations became involved. And this is very fascinating. Here am I, a professor in a very small college, teaching a class of about maybe 30 students, but they attach such great importance to this that within a very short space of time, you know, the major Jewish organizations became involved, and it became a national event. You know, for example, you found that on a Sunday morning the week was David Brinkley on ABC TV. You know, would have a whole segment dealing with this question with my telling my students that the Jews were involved in the slave trade. Up to now, I'm still a little astounded, considering the prominence that what to me was a totally inconsequential thing was given. Now, shortly after all of this started, four of the major Jewish organizations issued a joint press release attacking me. The ADL, the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Congress, and the Jewish Community Relations Council of Boston or Greater Boston or something like that. They themselves said afterwards that this was somewhat unprecedented, that four of these major Jewish organizations should have combined their efforts to attack one little obscure professor in a small school. They themselves admitted that this was somewhat unprecedented. They also admitted that apparently this press release was issued in the middle of one of their high holidays, of which there are quite a few, I understand, and it was somewhat unusual for them to sort of disturb the sanctity of this high holiday by issuing something along these lines. Now, I actually saw, you know, one of the original press releases, and I have likened it to a medieval scroll. It reminded me of the movies I saw as a boy with Robin Hood, where the sheriff of Nottingham would go into Sherwood Forest, and he would unroll a long proclamation, and he would tuck it on a tree, you know, saying, "Robin Hood, beware, you're looking for you," that kind of a thing. This was literally a scroll, literally. You couldn't read it without having to unroll it. It was literally. I've never seen anything like it. And it was signed with, it had the logos of all of these four organizations. And this, you know, opened my eyes to the proclivity of these folks to tell lies. Now, this proclamation told the world that I was refusing to let my students discuss this information. First of all, it presented me as providing wrong, you know, information, blatantly false information, as another Jewish person described it to my classroom. And it said that I was refusing, here was I in a classroom apparently ramming this stuff down my students' throats and forbidding any discussion, which was absolutely, hideously untrue. It said that I had a history of all kinds of problems with my school, and that my colleagues had been complaining about me for many years. Up to now, I have no inkling of what these complaints could possibly be. I know of no such incidents, certainly not before this time. I was able to take this press release to my class and read it to the very class, and it was a very good learning experience for the students, because here were the students who I was accused of misleading and whatnot, and I was able to show them themselves the kind of information that makes it into the major media. One of the interesting lies that came out around this time was the rabbi, the campus rabbi. She came to my office. It's a she, actually. She came to my office, complaining about my teaching this information. So I told her, well, look, if you think this information is false, why don't you come to my class? I will invite you to my classroom, and you can come to my class. I'm going to allow you to stand up in front of my class and explain to them what's wrong about this information, and then we can have a debate in front of the class. And she agreed. But of course, she quickly changed her mind. And not only did she change her mind, but then she put it out that I had refused to discuss the material with her. So point number one is their proclivity to tell lies. Point number two was a very interesting proclivity towards attempting to damage one's professional credibility. There was a tendency to libel and slander whoever they were, upset with. In this case, it was me. There was one Jewish gentleman about 50 years old who began making anonymous calls, random calls to the campus. He would call the dorms, he would call people's offices just randomly, and he would tell them he was a Jewish student at Harvard University. He would tell them that he had discovered that I did not really have a PhD and that I was not qualified to be teaching at Wellesley College. This was one of the more bizarre examples of the attempt to discredit me, professionally. There was a gentleman who I subsequently brought a libel case against, and I lost. I brought about three cases, lost them all. But this gentleman suggested that I was an affirmative action PhD. The only reason I got a PhD was because, of affirmative action. He said the only reason why I got tenure at Wellesley College, I was one of the youngest professors ever tenured at Wellesley College. But he said the reason why I got tenure at Wellesley College was because they were afraid of me. I was this great black loudmouth person. So just to keep me quiet, they decided to give me tenure. One of the most interesting of these efforts to discredit me was by a gentleman called Leon Wieseltier, or maybe Wieseltier, I don't know. He describes himself as a literary editor of the New Republic magazine. Now, the Washington Post Book World in 1994, I think it was, at the height of this, and up to now I'm kind of surprised at this, but at the height of all the hysteria around this question, the Washington Post Book World invited me to review four new books, for the issue on Sunday, which I did. They gave me a lot of space. It was the longest book review in that issue. And predictably, in the very next week's issue, there were two or three outraged letters from Jewish individuals asking the Washington Post Book World, if they weren't aware who this person was that they had allowed to grace their pages. This was the great anti-Semite Tony Martin. Don't you know who this is? How can you let him write in this kind of a prestigious journal? And this guy, Wieseltier, went a step further. The title of my book is The Jewish Onslaught, and the subtitle is Dispatches from the Wellesley Battlefront. Now, I spell dispatches D-E-S. Most Americans spell it D-I-S. I grew up in a British tradition, in a British colony, and up to this day, I spell honor H-O-N-O-U-R. Most of you do not. So the E is a British spelling. And this idiot obviously didn't realize that there were alternative spellings of the word dispatches. And again, so anxious are they to try to discredit people who they disagree with. This guy actually, told the Washington Post Book World in his letter that I was so ignorant and stupid I couldn't even spell the word dispatches. And look how stupid I was. And this was a stupid kind of a person that they were allowing to publish in their journal. Luckily for me, the editor of the Washington Post Book World was one of those rare persons who was apparently not too cowed by the Jewish onslaught, and she wrote a very nice letter back, a rejoinder, telling Wiesel Thier that she had checked two dictionaries, and in both of them, she saw dispatches spelled with an E, you know, as one of the optional spellings of the word. Then there was Mary Lefkowitz, the great Mary Lefkowitz, one of my colleagues at Wellesley College, who wrote in a little literary magazine that I'd never seen before, but she wrote in this magazine, she actually alleged that I'd physically assaulted a white student. Now, I teach in a women's college. So, you know, so here is she playing into, I guess, you know, all these perceptions of this big black rapist or whatever. But she actually alleged that I actually physically pushed down a white student. This would be a young white woman, and the woman fell down. Then she said, I bent over her and raged. That was the word she used. I raged. I bent over her and raged. You know, one had this vision of this raging animal, you know. So, of course, I brought a libel suit against her. And one of the things I discovered was that, you know, these folks are very, very well positioned in the court system. So in fact, after having lost, I guess, two libel suits, I'm beginning to think that they must have had something to do with fashioning the libel laws in this country. Because in this case, you know, Lefkowitz actually acknowledged that what she said was wrong. You know, and she acknowledged that she had not taken due care in ascertaining the facts. And even those acknowledgments were not enough for me to win the case. You know, I had to prove that she had acted with reckless abandon and all kinds of things. But it was a very interesting learning experience for me, you know, how the libel laws, because once, especially once they identify you as what they call a public person, the way the libel laws in this country are organized, once you are identified as a public person, people basically have carte blanche. They can say anything about you. It can be true, it can be false. They don't have to do their research. They can say anything they want, almost. I mean, it's almost that bad. So these are some of the efforts to discredit me. Of course, I don't think they succeeded, but again, this was the very persistent effort to sort of tarnish your image. And very much aligned to this, of course, was the generalized question of character as assassination. This was part of that effort to damage one's credibility. There was also the tactic of what I describe as dirty tricks. Of course, this too is a subset within the general rubric of lies, I suppose. For example, there's a group at Wellesley College called the Friends of Wellesley Hillel. Hillel is a Jewish student organization which exists around the country on I guess, most campuses. I remember reading in Paul Finley's book, The Dare to Speak Out, he says in there that the Hillel groups are actually trained. They are formally trained, apparently, by the ADL and other organizations in tactics, you know, how to disrupt meetings, how to, you know, push false propaganda on campuses and so on. And so I don't know for a fact, but certainly those Hillel students who were part of the campaign against me did appear to have been people who were professionally trained. In fact, the whole campaign against me was initiated by students from the Hillel group. They sat in on my class on the first day of the semester, just for one day. And somehow from that one day's class, where I didn't really even talk about the subject, they somehow figured out that I was teaching this book as fact. Apparently, they figured that if I was teaching the book as hate literature, quote unquote, that would be okay. But the fact that I was teaching the book as just any other book, you know, having, you know, basic academic credibility, that, of course, they considered to be a grossly anti-Semitic thing. And they were the ones who raised the hue and cry. But there's a group on campus called the Friends of Wellesley Hillel. This is a group of faculty and alumni who work very closely with the Hillel students. And in the midst of this campaign, they actually put together a packet of mostly libelous information and mailed it to the mother of one of the students who was very, very vocal, you know, on my behalf. The students rallied around me. And these folks, you know, it's quite incredible the limits to these, you know, the extent towards, you know, to which these folks would operate. They, you know, this is a group of grown people. In fact, people like deans of the college, professors, people like that, took the time to sit on, put together a packet of basically lies and misinformation to send it. You know, they actually targeted this one student because she was a leader of the, you know, of the group of students who were supporting me, and sent this information to her mother. Somebody came and tacked up a flyer around my office one day. I wasn't in the office, alleging sexual misconduct between myself and the same student because she was so, you know, vocal on my behalf. Of course, it didn't work, fortunately for me. They started a rumor at one point that if I wrote recommendations for any students, the students would not get jobs and would not get, you know, entry into graduate school or anything. But these were some of the kinds of what I call dirty tricks. There was also the tactic of what I call going for the economic juggler. You know, from very early, they evinced a very concentrated effort to try to remove my ability to survive economically. One of the things, for example, that joint press release called for my expulsion from the college. It called for my tenure to be revoked. So again, you know, it seems to me that that's one of the hallmarks of the tactics here, and I'm sure that this is of wider application than just my subjective case. There was also the tactic of what I call great presumptuousness. I heard somebody last night mention the word chutzpah. I call it presumptuousness. You know, the idea that a rabbi, you know, the student chaplain could come into my office to demand, you know, why am I teaching this information? That to me is sheer presumptuousness. You know, my response basically, even though I was polite, but the intent of my response was, well, who the hell are you, you know, to come into here to tell me what I must teach, you know, in a black studies class. I'm an expert on black studies. Who the hell are you, you know? I didn't say it in those terms, but that was the import of what I was saying. I remember, and I mentioned this, I believe, in the introduction to my book, but before this Jewish onslaught began with me, just by sheer coincidence, a few months earlier, I was doing some research in a Jewish archive in New York City, and at that time, a case similar to mine had just erupted concerning Professor Len Jeffries at City College in New York City. He had made a speech in Albany, New York, in which he had pointed out that the Jews had a very large hand in fashioning Hollywood. In fact, there's a book by a Jewish author called An Empire of Our Own. And the subtitle, interestingly enough, is How the Jews Invented Hollywood. This is a Jewish writer. His name is Neil. And Neil Gabler. An Empire of Our Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. What could be more explicit than that? He is boasting in the book, you know, the way the Jews basically shaped American popular culture. So Len Jeffries, in his speech in Albany, said, well, okay, so you all invented American popular culture. You have to take, you know, a large portion of the blame for the negative stereotypes, concerning black folk that have been nurtured by Hollywood over the years. But, of course, they want to have their cake and eat it. They want to invent Hollywood, but they don't want to take responsibility for the negative, you know, elements coming out of Hollywood. So he was branded as anti-Semitic, as usual, for having said that. So when I went to this Jewish archive, my own case had not yet, emerged, but you know they tried to put me through this litmus test. It was almost as though they would not let me use the archives unless I, you know, disavowed any kind of knowledge and so on. And the woman in charge, she asked me, you know, do you know Len Jeffries? You know, I said yes, I know him. He's a good friend of mine, he's a colleague of mine, and she was very upset. But again, there's this presumptuousness, this feeling that they have a right to put you through all these litmus tests, a right to demand of you why you are doing something which is totally correct and totally inoffensive and would be inoffensive to anybody else. Another tactic which I think I can distill out of my experience is a tendency to sidestep the real issues. I discovered that throughout this whole, it's almost 10 years now, they would almost never engage me on the facts of the matter. They would say, okay, Jews weren't involved in the slave trade, you're a big anti-Semitic, so I'd say, well, okay, well, let's discuss it. You know, were Jews indeed half of the slave owners in Brazil in the 17th century? I'd say, look at your own Encyclopedia Judaica. It says that Jews were half the slave owners in Brazil. You know, but they'll never engage that kind of factual debate, never. They'll always go off on a tangent, try to besmirch your character, try to take away your economic, you know, wherewithal and so on. but they will almost never, they studiously avoid ever engaging, you know, the actual facts of the matter. I had a graphic illustration of this just a few weeks ago when this question flared very briefly again on my campus. You know, somebody mentioned that I had 10 years ago taught these blatant falsehoods and whatnot, so I responded in the newspaper. And a couple of Jewish students wrote back, you know, responding to me. And again, you know, and in my response, I laid out, you know, several examples of Jewish historians acknowledging their involvement in the slave trade. There was no reference to this at all. Instead, they began talking about stories of coming out of Europe in the Middle Ages or sometime about Jews killing white kids to take their blood and put it in matzos and stories about their Jewish Holocaust, all kind of stuff, you know, but had nothing to do with anything. You know, and in fact, I now responded asking them, well, what does all of this have to do with the point that I'm making? Did you not read my article? Did you not see the evidence I gave you concerning Jewish involvement in the slave trade? What does somebody, you know, killing somebody for their blood to put in the matzo have to do with the slave trade? But this is always their tendency. They will studiously avoid the facts, avoid the issue at hand, but bring in all kinds of, you know, off what we call in you know, popular parlance, red herrings, off the wall stuff, red herrings. And this is a very persistent tactic that I was able to discern. Another tactic, and this is similar, I guess, maybe saying the same thing in different ways, but that is the tendency to introduce, you know, men of straw, straw men. You know, for example, I'm discussing Jewish involvement in the slave trade, but somebody is going to write an article saying that I alleged, which is not true, the Jews were genetically predispositioned towards enslaving others. Now, this has nothing to do with anything that I was talking about. But they, again, you know, they will totally disregard the facts of the case and introduce something totally different. And what they tend to do is they will introduce a man of straw, put the straw thing on the record, and then they will proceed to attack the man of straw that they have created. Yes. And because they have such great influence in the media, this man, this straw man, this false information, all of a sudden becomes part of the record, even in the courthouse. You know, they'll go into court and reference the same lies that they put in the newspaper as though this is some disinterested source, some third party. And then this brings me to the next point I was going to make, and that was precisely that, their ability to plant misinformation on the record and then use that information as though it is some kind of a, you know, a well-documented primary source. Point number 10, what I call the use of quislings, surrogates, and what in the black community we call Uncle Toms. They have developed this art to a very high level, at least in my case, around the black community. I mentioned Skip Gates at Harvard University. There are many other notorious figures like that in the black community who were all too willing to do their bidding. I must say that these folks were very, very well recompensed. You know, these folks have been given incredible prominence. These folks now go around the, you know, the world speaking, and you know, for $15,000 at a time. You know, these are the kind of honorariums these folks get now. They've all been given endowed chairs in their universities. Many of them are very, very weak scholars. You know, can hardly put two sentences together. But because they've been willing to play this game, they have been, you know, being elevated to prominence. Every time you pick up the New York Times, you'll see them on the cover of the Sunday magazine. Any issue that comes up pertaining to black folk, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be history of Africa. It could be contemporary politics in the Caribbean. It doesn't matter what it is. They are quoted as the authorities and so on. You know, you see them on PBS hosting, you know, all kinds of multi-million dollar programs and documentaries and so on. But this element, I think, has been a very effective tactic on their part to identify people from within, in this case, my own group, but people who were willing to, in a sense, you know, sell themselves for the, you know, admittedly very ample rewards that they were given as a result. Another tactic is their ability to leverage off of the influence which they undoubtedly have in high places. At Wellesley College, for example, you know, we had a new president coming into Wellesley College just as my thing was moving to its climax, so to speak. And this new president came into the college not knowing anything about what was happening before. And somehow these folks got her to write a letter, which I suspect they must have drafted themselves, because she had no real knowledge of the background of what was happening. But this letter, it is said, based on newspaper reports, was sent out to maybe 40 to 60,000 people. This was a letter condemning me for teaching the Jews who were involved in the slave trade. So you had the incoming president of Wellesley College sending out 40 to 60,000 letters. This must be unprecedented in the annals of American higher education. I think this is something for the Guinness Book of World Records, where a president of a university sends out possibly 60,000 letters condemning one of her own professors for teaching something that is historically true. I've never ever heard of such a case. In fact, maybe I will indeed write to the Guinness Book of Records and see if they can immortalize me by putting this in there. Then there was the American Historical Association. Three of these Jewish historians actually went to the American Historical Association and got the American Historical Association to decree, that's the only term I can use, to decree by executive fiat that Jews were not involved in the slave trade. I've never ever heard of any such thing. This is just totally antithetical to the way that academia operates. You know, who has ever heard of such a thing? You know, historical fact being determined by presidential decree from the American Historical Association. We decree. You know, it's like the papal bulls in the Middle Ages. You know, it's a papal bull. You know, we decree that Jews were not involved in the slave trade. You know, it is absolutely amazing. But they actually succeeded in having this done. Then there's one of the most amazing cases of all, where I was invited to speak in the city of Worcester, Massachusetts, by Worcester State College, around about 1994 or 95. And the Jewish groups were actually able to get the mayor of Worcester. Worcester is one of the largest cities in Massachusetts. They were able to get the mayor of Worcester to call together a special press conference in which he had the leaders of all the major religions in the place. He had the Roman Catholic head, he had a Baptist head, you know, heads of various Protestant denominations, various, you know, rabbis, ADL types, and so on. This man assembled an entire coalition of religious and apparently civil rights organizations for what? To denounce me prior to my appearance at Worcester State College. They had tried to put pressure on the college and the people who invited me. To their great credit, you know, they were strong. They said, and they refused to bow, you know, and they invited me and I spoke. But here were these groups, powerful enough to get the mayor of a major city. You would think that the mayor had, you know, important things to do. You know, the mayor to put together a special conclave and a huge press release to denounce me about a day or two. And of course the result was that my speech, when it did indeed take place, drew the largest audience in the history of the school. Actually, I didn't include this in my talk, but I really should have included it as one of the tactics, their tendency on occasion to shoot themselves in the foot. Because this whole incredible story of the Jewish involvement in the slave trade, I mean, if they'd left me alone, I think the only people who would have known of their involvement would have been my 30 students and myself. But of course, now the whole world knows about it, and the question of African, you know, slavery will never, ever again be raised without the question of the Jewish input being part of the discussion, whether they deny it or not. But it is now in the forefront, you know, of people's consciousness. And this is due to them. I mean, I could never have promoted this idea the way that they did. Another tactic, I'm going to end up in a couple of minutes, but another tactic is, of course, the use of the major media. They become very agitated when one speaks of their control of the media. I mean, that's one of the most anti-Semitic things that it is possible for anybody to say. And yet, as in the case of the Jewish involvement in Hollywood, they themselves, you know, they boast about their prominence in the media. In fact, in my book, In the Jewish Onslaught, I quote Charles Silberman, a Jewish author. He wrote a book back in the 80s, I think, called A Certain People. And he boasts in that book about the fact that he says that at that time there were seven major top editors of the New York Times. He said all seven were Jews. He talked about the major TV networks, and where I forget the precise figure, but the majority of the senior producers, you know, in the TV stations were all Jews, he said. And the producers are the people who really dictate, you know, what gets in the news, what stays out, what spin is put on information and so on. So the people who were crucial to spinning the news, he was saying were primarily Jews. He named names. And I quoted him in my book, but you know, but I became anti-Semitic for quoting him, which was not unusual. When that huge scroll, that press release scroll, you know, was issued by the four major Jewish organizations, the Boston Globe, the major newspaper in Boston, the Boston Globe published four major articles, including editorials and op-eds, within about 6 days, attacking me on that question, including an op-ed in the Sunday paper, including an editorial. This is a major editorial on the editorial page, a major editorial. Again, fraught with lies and distortions. I sent in a letter responding to them. They refused to publish my letter. So they had four letters, not letters, four editorials, you could say, attacking me in less than a week, and refused to publish my rejoinder. And so that's a great sort of a tactic, because these folks have such sway over the major media. It gives them a very great advantage. I remember being interviewed for the Fox front page program. They interviewed me for over an hour. But I guess that my responses to the questions were so tight that they could not find, you know, any soundbite to extract and make me look bad. And so what they did is they gave me a couple of soundbites, maybe half a second each. But instead of letting me talk, they had some kind of a narrator who spent about 5 minutes telling folks what I had said, but not letting me say anything practically, you know, and that too is one of the tactics. The use of organizations is another tactic. Of course, I don't have to tell this audience about the ADL. I heard Brad Smith talking about the ADL's mention of him on their website. I think I also have pride of place on the website. For several years, I haven't checked recently, but for several years, I used to have honorable mention every year in the list of anti-Semitic, occurrences and so on. They would list the anti-Semitic occurrences of the previous year, and there would be something like Tony Martin gave a lecture at XYZ College, and that in itself would be an anti-Semitic event, the fact that I gave a lecture someplace. The ADL actually wrote a book about me, which I haven't read yet. I've had it for years. I haven't got around to reading it. It's called something like, I think they took my title and turned it around, something like The Jewish Onslaught of Tony Martin, or Tony Martin's Onslaught Against the Jews, something like that. But it's a whole big book, one of their so-called reports, an ADL report. Another tactic is what I call the unseemly histrionics. When I spoke at Worcester State College, there was a Jewish lady, I think her name was Schneider or something, but there was a Jewish lady who was on the Board of Trustees of Worcester State College. And she resigned from the Board of Trustees amidst great fanfare because of the school's invitation to me. And that's what I call nothing but stupid histrionics. But it got a lot of press, of course. It created a lot of interest in the media. But again, it was a case of shooting herself in the foot, because I remember they had me initially scheduled for an auditorium that held about 100 people. But when the hysteria, generated by themselves developed, they had to change it to the venue, to the largest auditorium they had, which held about 300 people. And that wasn't big enough. So eventually, when I turned up on a cold, wintry morning in February, they had that 300 capacity auditorium totally full. Then they had to run closed circuit televisions outside for another 300 people to hear what I had to say. And of course, my speech got to be front page news in the Worcester Telegram and Gazette next morning and so on. But all of that aided by these ignorant histrionics. One of the things they do too is to try to pin what I call a nickname on you. They try to find some little slip of tongue or some little thing they can take out of context. And if they find it, then every time your name is mentioned in the media, they stick that on you. For example, Minister Louis Farrakhan from the Nation of Islam, he made a slip one once. He was talking about the fact that I mentioned earlier, the fact that 75% of Jewish households, in 1830 owned slaves. But he kind of got it wrong, as one often does in the midst of a speech, a little slip of the tongue. And when he said it, it came out as Jews own 75% of the slaves. Yeah, it was obviously a slip of the tongue. But, every time they mentioned him since, they always put that soundbite in, make it look like he was this great distorter of the truth. Here was Minister Farrakhan saying that, you know, Jews own 75% of the slaves and so on. In my case, fortunately for me, the most they could find on me was controversial. So every time they mention me, I get to be the controversial professor. They're also very good at the good cop, bad cop kind of a thing. You know, while some are trying to destroy you on one side, another one will come on the other side, and, you know, smiling and whatnot. But beware of the good cop. Very often it's better to deal with the bad cop, because a good one will get you in jail very often much more quickly and smoothly than the bad one will. Sometimes, too, they try to play you for a fool, you know. And they'll be trying to destroy you, and at the same time they're trying to destroy you, they're trying to give you advice. For example, last year when I decided to accept David Irving's invitation to speak in Cincinnati, you know, there was a guy whose name I don't recall, but he sent me an email, you know, telling me what a racist David Irving was. He sent me this copy of some poem that David Irving had written, saying he didn't want his daughter to marry a Rastafarian or something, you know, which is neither here nor there as far as I'm concerned. You know, that's you know, doesn't mean anything to me. It's neither here nor there. If he wants his daughter to marry Rastafarian or anybody else, or not marry them, so what? You know, that has nothing to do with anything as far as I'm concerned. But again, you know, here are people who are trying to destroy me, people who have spent the last 10 years trying to portray me as all kinds of things, trying to take my livelihood away, you know, and these same people, you know, can have the, you know, the I guess, chutzpah, I guess, to try now to tell me, to warn me against somebody else. You know, the whole idea of it is just totally amazing to me. Of course, I didn't pay any great attention to what these guys were trying to say. One of their tactics, too, was hate mail. I discovered that their propensity for hate mail was absolutely amazing. Up to now, I still get a lot of hate emails. I get, just about a few days ago, I got a hate postcard. You know, and on the one hand, they try to portray themselves as, you know, as these great liberal types, but there's this sort of a underbelly, you know, at the same time. So while in the public, you know, in the public light, they're trying to portray themselves as liberals and nice folks and whatnot, at the very same time, simultaneously. It's like a two-pronged attack, you know, but at the very same time, you're getting this other kind of stuff, which also reminds me of the tendency towards violence. There was one Jewish guy, he said he was a Russian Jew, he said he was, a man called Alexander Nechayevsky, who actually came onto my campus, said he came to get me. Luckily, I wasn't there to be gotten that day. I was somewhere out of town. But he came to the office saying he had come to get me and whatnot. They had to call the campus police for him, and he was given an order not to, a trespass order, I think they called it, not to appear on the campus again. So these then are some of the kinds of tactics, and there are others, but I know my time is up. But these are some of the kinds of tactics that I have been able to distill from my subjective interaction with these folks over the last maybe 9 or 10 years. And again, I've been very fascinated by the fact as I've become, you know, more broadly aware of you know, of similar situations involving different kinds of circumstances, that it seems to me that many of these kinds of tactics may in fact be tactics of much more generalized application. And I'll end by saying simply that I don't know what's necessarily the best way to respond, but I can just maybe outline very quickly the ways that I have tried to respond. I have tried to respond, first of all, by trying to stand on principle. From the very beginning, I've said that, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm talking the truth. The Jews were indeed involved in the slave trade. I'm not aware of what your problem is. And as long as I am convinced in my own mind that I'm talking the truth, then that's it. You know, that I've tried to disregard all of the other foolishness. And I've tried to stand on the truth. For example, I've been on TV many times debating people from American Jewish Committee and so on. And again, in that face-to-face debate, all of these tactics come into play. They try to attack your credibility, your character. But what I've always tried to do in those exchanges is to ignore, as far as I can, all of the ad hominem attacks and so on, and concentrate on the facts. So they'll say Tony Martin's an anti-Semite, I'll just ignore it. I'll say 75% of Jewish households own slaves, according to the 1830 census. I'll stick to the facts, and I use those kinds of media appearances as an opportunity to inform whoever happens to be listening. I've also tried where I could, to myself, leverage off of their media power. There have been times when they have unwittingly given me an opportunity, you know, to appear before the mass media, and I've used those opportunities to the hilt. Again, to push facts. I know I only have 30 seconds, and I try to ram as many facts and into those 30 seconds as I can, and let's forget all the anti-Semitic stuff. Deal with that later. I've also tried to develop, to my limited resources, you know, some kind of an independent response. I find that independence is a very, very, very great benefit. You know, I started my own little publishing company. It's a little company, but it was very, very effective. You know, the Jewish onslaught got out there and sold like hotcakes, and it really made a difference. You know, just to have some kind of an independent medium. Didn't matter. It wasn't a major corporation or anything, but it was independent. I controlled it, and I was able to fight back to some degree. I think it's important, too, to have some kind of a support structure. I was very fortunate. They attacked me at a time when I already had established a pretty good sort of a support structure in academia. I was relatively well known. It wasn't as easy for them to destroy my credibility as it might have been for people who were perhaps less accomplished. But I found that having a support structure and being able to avail oneself of the support of that structure was very important. And finally, in my case, I tried wherever possible to take the battle to them. I didn't sit back and wait. You know, once the battle was joined, I think in the early days especially, I think that they weren't used to having people fight back the way that I did. I think it sort of threw them off balance. You know, they came at me with all the usual, you know, bag of tricks, expecting me to fold immediately. But once I was able to fight back, and once it began to appear to them that they had a long, protracted struggle on their hands and not an easy victory, it took them a while to actually try to regroup and figure out what to do. So I just offer these as perhaps, you know, things for folks to think about in their response. Thank you very much.